I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. There's been a rise in the popularity of authoritarian leaders and political parties that have populist appeal. That's been true in Europe with Marine Le Pen's National Front in France. Turkish voters just gave their president more power. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte was known as the Punisher when he was a mayor, was accused of extrajudicial killings, and was voted into power promising law and order. The crisis in Venezuela can be laid in many ways at the feet of its authoritarian leadership. And here in the U.S., many of Donald Trump's supporters were attracted to his "only I can fix it" message, promising to drain the swamp, stop immigration, and branding the press as the enemy. He, as we know, has also expressed his affection for strong leaders like Russian President Vladimir Putin. Today on Radio Times, the appeal and the danger of authoritarian populism, and we have two guests who have joined us. Howard Levine is Arlene C. Carlson Professor of Political Science and Psychology at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center for the Study of Political Psychology. His most recent book is Open versus Closed: Personality, Identity, and the Politics of Redistribution. Howard Levine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Manu Bhagavan, and he is a professor of history and human rights at Hunter College and the Graduate Center at CUNY, the City University of New York. His most recent book is The Peacemakers, India and the Quest for One World. Manu Bhagavan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Manu, let me begin with you and actually quote something that you wrote recently in QZ.com. You said, "I believe the international authoritarian moment can be explained by three interconnected factors: the globalization of the economy and the emergence of gargantuan non-state multinational corporate actors, the globalization of conflict as manifest in the long war on terror, and the globalization of crisis as with public health and environmental threats." How has all this globalization, as you defined it, led to authoritarianism?
Right. So as you identified in your intro, we've seen a pattern of peoples in democratic societies turning towards strong men, or in some cases, strong women leaders, with the intention of warding off a set of threats that they believe that they face. The three factors that you note that I've identified, the globalization of economy, of conflict, and of crises, basically feed a sense of personal and economic insecurity amongst people in societies. And in democratic ones, the first line of defense is our local government. And so people have turned to our representatives and said, hey, we're worried about this, we're worried about that. Can you do something about it? And in fact, they can't. In some cases, they've actually tried, and in some cases, they haven't. But by and large, they failed. And they failed because the problems that we face are international in nature, and no one government can address the solution. Our international institutions, unfortunately, part of the liberal international order as it's known, have also failed. And it's these twin failures that have fed our moment of crisis.
And I do want to pick up on all of that. Let me get you in on the conversation, Howard Levine. As a psychologist, someone who mixes psychology and politics, how should we understand, I guess, the psychological features of authoritarianism?
Well, I think what is perhaps most important to realize, and perhaps what's most understood, is that it's not that authoritarianism is increasing. It's not that the population is becoming more authoritarianism. Rather, it's that levels of authoritarianism that are stable in the public are becoming politicized. And they're becoming politicized both in the short-term sense, which we saw in the election, whereby people that were high in authoritarianism moved to the right to support Donald Trump, people that were low moved toward the left to support Hillary Clinton, and in a longer term, more sort of secular sense, in which high authoritarians have moved into the Republican Party, low authoritarians have moved into the Democratic Party. So it's now capturing, that is, authoritarianism's capturing party identification, which is the strongest input to political perception, preference, and choice. And so I think these two forces together are adding up to a rather stark difference in what we've seen compared to past elections.
And can we say, Howard, that some of the features of authoritarianism is this sense of traditional values, a kind of obedience to authority? Or are these some of the features that are at play?
There are a number of defining features. I think it's important to start off with the idea that this is a heritable personality trait. So just as we inherit physical features from our parents, we also inherit at least the propensity for behavioral traits or personality traits. And perhaps the central aspect of authoritarianism is a general orientation of deference toward authorities and conventionalism, and also coupled with a punitiveness and animosity toward what are understood or proposed as deviant outgroups, ethnic, racial minorities, sexual orientation minorities. And all of this is combined with a skeptical view of democracy itself, which I think is partly what Manu was alluding to.
And just a quick follow-up there to you, Howard. Are you saying that then people that grow up in authoritarian families are likely to vote for an authoritarian leader?
They are, but not primarily because they've been socialized within authoritarian families, but that genes have been passed from parent to child. Now, this is something that's been in the literature over the past two decades that's sort of overriding the sort of socialization literature that we assumed to be the mechanism. So it appears less that it's socialization within the family and more the transmission of genes.
Well, that's interesting. Let me go back to you, Manu. And you talk about some of the failures or the inability of institutions to deal with all these globalized changes. And I would assume that explains some of the fear and insecurity and even some of the scapegoating that's going on.
Well, right. So we can take a couple of different examples. You might take a look at Greece. With the crisis, the recent crisis that they faced, they voted in a left-wing sort of populist government, the Syriza government. Syriza sort of pushed back on international austerity measures, which were part of a larger package which we call neoliberal reforms that Europe was pushing on Greece, led by the IMF. And Syriza said, this isn't really not working for us. We don't think this is a good idea. They sort of arm twisted them, and the finance minister, Varoufakis, had to resign. The net result, though, was that there was loss of faith in international institutions to solve the crisis from mm-hmm. within Greece, and there was greater animosity towards international norms sort of produced by all this. And the IMF, in its own internal reports, wound up saying they sort of made the wrong decisions and the wrong choice. So some of this has to do with policies we've been following for a couple of decades, recent event on the political stage, the emergence of new actors and perfect storms in a series of places that have all come together. So that's sort of what we're facing right now. In different contexts, I think it's important to recognize this plays out a little bit differently in each scenario. So
sure.
What we can do is talk about things broadly, and then we'd have to focus in on each location for the specifics.
And we will certainly try to do that during this hour. As you were talking, Manu, I was thinking about the refugee crisis that has affected, or seems to have affected, the politics in Europe, and the fact, as you indicate, the inability of governments to figure out how to absorb all these people without upsetting the local population.
Exactly. So the war in Syria has produced a massive wave of refugees, part of this can be seen as part of the larger war on terror, the long war, as I call it. In that context, with longer discussions about the place of minorities in pluralistic societies, specifically how do people who identify as Muslim or follow Islam, how do they practice their faith in certain ways? And some people find that fearful, and some people respond that that's preposterous, that that's the very definition of pluralism. And this has created tensions throughout Europe's multicultural fabric, as people then, on top of it, now respond to these waves of refugees, as you've identified, coming in, sort of trying to fit into these culturally somewhat endogamous societies of the former nation states of Europe, or current nation states of Europe, but within the EU parameter. And then this is feeding tensions about How do they fit into the democratic societies? Where do rules of freedom, liberty, and the rule of law apply? And how do social benefits accrue to them versus people in their own societies who are hurting economically? Or are they incorporated into those societies as well? So that's you're exactly right. Yeah.
I mean, Howard, is there an American, uniquely American version of either authoritarianism or authoritarian populism as we're talking during this hour?
I think what we're all witnessing, you know, is that this is happening across the Western world and beyond. The question about whether, you know, there are aspects that are particular to America, I think there are aspects particular to, you know, each country's political moment. So I think the general dynamic, you know, is that authoritarianism either can be politicized or not, and what politicizes authoritarianism is some notion of threat. And typically, it is a threat of diversity, whether it's diversity of people, ideas, or behavior. And so the terrorist attacks that occurred during 2016 in Orlando and San Bernardino, and then more generally the refugee crisis in Syria, threatened to increase diversity. And that tends to politicize and activate authoritarianism. So I think the general dynamic is quite generalized. That is what you're seeing in France, what you're seeing more broadly in Europe, and in 2016, I think, can be understood within the rubric of the activation of authoritarianism on the basis of a threat and threat to diversity, or threat of diversity in particular. With respect to the American context, I think that there has been, over the past 40 years, really beginning in 1968 with, you know, Nixon's Southern strategy, a populist, increasingly populist Republican Party that saw its electoral fortunes as being better aided by the cultural dimension of politics than by fighting over, you know, the New Deal, you know, spend more, spend less dimension. And this has become more and more central in American politics, and certainly after Pat Buchanan's 1992 speech at the Republican National Convention, the parties have become increasingly branded in cultural rather than economic terms. And so I think that's what's unique about the American context.
And we're up on a break here, and I'm just thinking in time, we will become a majority-minority country, which could add to what you just said there. Howard Levine, professor of political science and psychology at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center for the Study of Political Psychology. Also with us is Manu Bhagavan, and he's a professor of history and human rights at Hunter College and the Graduate Center at CUNY at the City University of New York. We're talking about the rise, the popularity of authoritarianism. And we want to hear from you. You can text or call our comment line. That phone number is 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Manu Bhagavan and Howard Levine about the appeal, the danger of authoritarian populism. And we see folks joining the conversation. We will get those people and those comments in on the conversation as the hour progresses. I do want to just play a clip, and I do not want to do this whole hour about Donald Trump, but I think based on what we were just talking about, this montage picks up on a number of those comments. And this is both from the campaign and from the presidency.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
Yeah, I think the media is the opposition party in many ways. I understand what has to be done. I get things done. I've always been a closer.
We don't have a lot of closers in politics, and I understand why. It's a very rough system. It's an archaic system. You look at the rules of the Senate, even the rules of the House, but the rules of the Senate and some of the things you have to go through, it's really a bad thing for the country, in my opinion. They are archaic rules, and maybe at some point we're going to have to take those rules on.
I alone can fix it.
Manu Bhagavan, does that sound like an authoritarian populist?
Well, let me put it this way. Sure. Those comments are certainly deeply disturbing, whatever one's political views. I think the fact is that there are Americans in this particular context, but this would be true for all of these other countries we've talked about as well, who are genuinely hurting. They're hurting for any number of reasons. They're hurting for economic reasons, say in coal country, or they're hurting for the loss of manufacturing jobs in places like Detroit. They could also be hurting because of deep-rooted fear and anxiety caused by the product of a natural catastrophe like Katrina in New Orleans still is suffering, or Superstorm Sandy in New York City. And what we're finding is that people like Mr. Trump are playing to these basest fears and anxieties. They're promising help, and they're also playing to sort of they're playing up people to blame. So all that list of people that he's talking about, whether it's Muslims coming into the country or Mexicans or whoever, these are scapegoats that it's easy to deflect people's problems. Just focus your fear, your anxiety, your anger at them, and then he can fix all of these other problems. So it plays to latent racism. And it's certainly in the context of Barack Obama's presidency, I'd say it's also a knee-jerk reaction to that. But in the context of these sort of other real things, and that's what's creating the potent mix and chemistry of why this is all very successful.
And those real things being just this sense that the future is going to be worse than either the present or the past, and somehow I am not going to be part of that a different kind of future. I'm going to become more like an outsider, a lesser player in the future, it seems.
Right, exactly. So a lot of people who've lost jobs, a lot of this has to do with technology and automation, and these processes are only going to accelerate as we move forward. But the first sense is, well, what am I going to do with my life? Or in the case of, say, solar versus coal, what am I going to do with my life? How do I refigure? Where do I fit in? And without very serious interventions, retraining, and the sense that we're all with you, we hear you, we want you to succeed too. We're all in this together. And that the roles could very easily be reversed, that, you know, the next people who could lose their jobs are us on the other side of the table. So unless we sort of come together in that sense, it's obvious that you're going to have a whole lost generation of people who, as you just said, have no sense of being vested in the future. And that's why they turn to these these attempts to restore the past, some kind of imagined mythological past glory.
Howard, can you weigh in on this as well? And we wanted to frame the show as both the appeal, I mean, trying to understand why these individuals and this message is so appealing to so many people, both here in the United States, but also around the world. And then obviously what happens next, but weigh in on the appeal part.
Let me begin with what I think is inherent in the clips that you played, and that is a swirl of both economic and cultural forces. And it's really very difficult to tease them apart. And so what is often thought to be the case, and I think this was raised in Manu's comments, that, you know, you have sort of divergent economic fortunes really beginning in 2012, but that have become much more apparent in 2016. And that dovetails, you know, as well with other sorts of problems, right, that white voters without college educations have been experiencing. On the other side is culture. And so there's been work, you know, that suggests that when you make clear to working class whites that where we have this coming majority-minority America, they tend to move to the right. So it's very difficult to separate out what is cultural threat and what is economic threat. And that's always been the case. But I would say that, you know, the analyses that I've seen, and, you know, you can see these on the Washington Post's monkey cage website, and you can see it in the data journalism, in the New York Times and elsewhere, that analyses that carefully attempt to measure and statistically model the impact of cultural and economic threat tend to find that culture matters more.
Hmm.
And this dovetails with a longer finding, a more long-standing finding, that self-interest effects in politics tend to be quite weak. And so it's hard, you know, ultimately to know whether what the public is responding to, right, are material changes or changes that threaten the cultural identity of the country.
And when you talk about culture, I'm thinking about this more diverse culture that we are. Some of the changes to culture, same-sex marriage, for instance, is that the kind of thing that, and maybe even our first black president, that these kind of dramatic changes in people's lives or in the culture make some people very nervous, Howard?
I think there are two dimensions to this, and I think you just hit on both of them. One is with respect to general tolerance on issues related to same-sex marriage, sexual orientation. And the other has to do, again, with ethnic and racial diversity. And so what you saw with respect to the rise of Obama was the racialization of politics. So racial attitudes mattered a great deal more in the 2008 and 2012 elections than they had ever previously. And all of this sort of amounts to what we would refer to as a status threat, right, to white Americans without college educations who have seen both their economic fortunes, right, and their dominant social status recede over the past decade. And Donald Trump really provided quite a, you know, target spot on, campaign to address, you know, precisely those issues.
Well, and it seems, Manu, that some of these leaders truly understand, and we're talking about in many ways democracies here, truly understand some of those fears and insecurities of their people.
I think that's right.
Yeah, let me just toss that to Manu, and then Howard, we'll get you back in.
Sure.
Well, exactly. I'm going to agree with Professor Levine. They certainly play to them very well. They know how to play to them very well. I don't know that they necessarily actually sympathize with people's fears and anxieties. For example, if one did, their solutions would be very different. Breaking up the European Union, for example, on the one hand, it certainly has many problems. But creating a world, sort of going back to a world of nation states without any kind of international norms and institutions that we have had in existence since the Second World War, that sort of turns a blind eye to the incredible crises that existed in the world before there was an international order of some kind. Mm-hmm. I'm very skeptical of all of these claims that jobs will return. I don't think that they will.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think that they in particular won't because of increasing technological change.
That does not bode well, though, does it?
No, it really doesn't.
Because we haven't really adapted to many of these changes.
That's right. What we need to be doing is adapting. What we need to be doing is saying, how can we create the jobs of the future? How do we retrain our citizens? How are we there for our neighbors? That's what we need to be saying. That's what we need to be asking. That's not what these promises are about.
Howard, do you want to weigh in on this? And then I do want to play a caller. We got some comments as well.
Yeah, what I would say, is that it's not necessarily about what, is prescriptively best for the long term. I think Donald Trump addressed both the cultural and economic anxieties, you know, of his voters in a way that Hillary Clinton, you know, just didn't. And I think what Trump did, quite beyond whether he means it or not, was to communicate that he cared, right, about these, you know, forgotten voters, whites, you know, non-college whites in rural areas that, you know, the Democratic Party has been perceived as having abandoned. And so, you know, it's hard to get, a group of people to listen to what you propose unless you can first convince them that, you know, politician cares about you And I think Donald Trump succeeded in doing that, and that was something that I think a lot of elites in the media and academia missed during the campaign.
And maybe even using the language of going after political correctness, and I'm thinking of all the language of the campaign trail that seemed to resonate, Howard, so much with Trump's voters.
Yeah, I mean, Trump varied in his use of implicit versus explicit racial language. Now, quite a bit of it early on was explicit, but as the campaign heated up in the fall, Trump, I think, cottoned on to the idea that he ought to be using dog whistles, which would otherwise alienate a broader swath of voters. But he certainly understood the political moment, right, the populist political moment, in a way that the Democrats and Hillary Clinton just did not.
And that's Howard Levine. He's a professor of political science and psychology at the University of Minnesota. Also with us, Manu Bhagavan, who teaches history and human rights at Hunter College. We are talking about the appeal, the rise of populism and authoritarianism, and also the potential dangers there as well. And again, you can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play someone that called our comment line.
My name is Frank from Philadelphia. I think the rise of authoritarian governments around the world and in this country and the United States is in part due to a vacuum of participatory democracy. What I mean by that is not enough people call their congressmen or go out and protest or join groups, and they want someone else to do it for them. And I think that's a mistake.
And that's Frank calling us from Philadelphia, although interestingly, after the election, a lot of protests. But let me go back to you, Manu, and you talk about the fact that many people don't feel as if the institutions that perhaps used to support them do as well. Are we also talking about a great deal of skepticism about our political institutions?
Well, that's been growing for some time. Yes, a skepticism of our domestic political institutions and skepticism of our international institutions. And it's a negative downward circle. That is, every time we already are skeptical, but yet we turn to them, they continue to fail because these are, as I said, very large, interconnected, globalized problems. And we don't have the mechanisms in place to adequately deal with them. So then we lose even more faith. This then turns more people off. So to the caller's point, one of the reasons why we have low participation in this country is because people feel that the institutions don't work for them. People feel that they put in their time and their effort and they don't get what they want out of the system or the system is non-responsive. However, I also do want to point out that there are other places around the world where you do in fact have high participation or higher participation, at least than the United States, and these places still have turned towards authoritarian regimes. So it isn't just about participation. It's about responsiveness and in my view, the failures that we are facing are endemic to our moment because the underlying drivers of our crises, our institutions cannot deal with them. So to put it in another way, the IMF, the World Bank, the EU, all of these institutions are largely are driven by bureaucracies, appointments from a handful of sort of selected officials. And the problem is that they themselves are automatically non-responsive because there is no democracy in these institutions. There's no direct democracy. So what I think we need to do is create direct democratic international institutions as a first step to ameliorate our problems.
To give people some sense of autonomy or power over these institutions, Manu?
Right. This is a connection between the local, the regional, the national, and the global. Our local institutions have to work. You need roads to be able to drive around your local community if you live in a semi-urban area or above, or progressively more urban. You need schools. You need those kinds of things to work, the local level. You need your regional place to be able to function, to get jobs and to, make the overall senses of different integrated communities have some sense of cohesion. But we also need global democratic forces as well, because when state to state, when states are interacting with one another and creating mechanisms for capital and finance to mobilize, we also need to be able to address the ways in which we're going to properly deal with mobilization of people, the free movement of peoples, the free and the restricted movement of things like vector-borne disease and so on.
And do you think, about a minute before our second break here, Howard, but do you think the kind of political, I don't know, disengagement or even suspicion about our political system, do you think that that creates or feeds into some of these authoritarian impulses?
Yeah, I think it does. I think one aspect that we haven't talked about is political polarization, right? So that the Republicans have moved more, you know, unanimously, homogeneously to the right, Democrats to the left, and there's no longer a common political conversation in the country. So, you know, 30 years ago, we had three channels, they were nonpartisan, and, you know, attendance to, you know, the nightly news was very high. Now what you've seen is the middle, meaning the moderates, becoming less participatory, in part because they're tuning out. And they're tuning out in part because the polarization is aversive, but they're also tuning out because now the media is providing a lot more choice and diversity. Okay, so if people wanted to watch television 30 years ago, you know, they had no choice but to watch the news. Now they can watch any number of other things, and so that's contributed to the falling out of the middle with respect to participation.
That is Howard Levine, again, teaches history and human rights at, is a professor of political science and psychology at the University of Minnesota. Also with us, Manu Bhagavan, who's a professor of history and human rights at Hunter College. We are talking about the rise of authoritarianism, authoritarian populism, if you will. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and like our caller, you can call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Earlier in the hour, I mentioned the fact that President Trump has expressed affection, even support, for strong men leaders. Let me play a montage of some of that support.
Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, right? He was a bad guy, really bad guy. But you know what he did well? He killed terrorists. He did that so good. They didn't read him the rights. They didn't talk. They were a terrorist. It was over.
We would be so much better off if Gaddafi were in charge right now.
If you look at North Korea, this guy, he's like a maniac. Okay? And you got to give him credit. How many young guys, he was like 26 or 25 when his father died, take over these tough generals, and all of a sudden, you know, it's pretty amazing when you think of it. How does he do that? Even though it is a culture and it's a cultural thing, he goes in, he takes over, and he's the boss. It's incredible. He wiped out the uncle. He wiped out this one, that one. I mean, this guy doesn't play games.
I just want to let everybody know, in case there was any doubt, that we are very much behind President El-Sisi. He's done a fantastic job in a very difficult situation. We are very much behind Egypt and the people of Egypt.
Putin is somebody that people are respecting all over the world now, and our country is just the opposite. I mean, you get the respect. I mean, to a certain extent, you have it or you don't have it. You have that ability to get respect. You're a leader or you're not a leader.
Howard Levine, how do authoritarians view each other?
Let me say that, you know, I think the clips that you played reflects something that's absolutely astonishing, which is that Donald Trump is, you know, almost a character out of central casting with respect to playing a strong man. And I think that reflects both who he really is, but I think there is another dynamic which might be more important, which is that Donald Trump is the enemy of their enemies, meaning that the reaction, you know, of the cultural elite to the kinds of comments that you played are so negative. And I think what Donald Trump supporters are playing off, right, is sort of the cultural polarization and the us versus them sort of identity groups that seem to characterize the political moment. So it's not just simply what Donald Trump says, it's the reaction he gets from the opponents of Trump's supporters. And I think that he's just simply magnifying the cultural polarization through this, you know, means.
So when he gets criticized for saying those things, you're saying, Howard, that his supporters double down on their candidate or their president.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, because much of what we're seeing in politics, you know, is not any kind of, you know, substantive reaction, right, to what a politician says or does, right? But it's the implications for the loyalty on one part or the other of the partisan system. And so what we know is that voters are very likely to change their substantive preferences once they decide who to support. Right, so they decided to support Donald Trump, and then they adopt his policy positions. They adopt his resentments. And so a lot of what we're seeing is following. Right? It's policy following. It's cultural resentment following. It's not that the politicians are trying to sort of match their policy ideas to the preferences of the public. The public, you know, is operating, I think, on a more psychological basis.
So interesting. Manu, anything you want to add to that?
I
have a question for you, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I'd simply say with respect to those clips, I think all of these folks, Mr. Trump being emblematic in the case of this specific set of examples, rally around braggadocio, sort of strong rhetoric, and this idea that they will be able to, you know, there's a sort of mutual admiration club, but it only goes so far. At the point at which there are real battles back and forth, either any sort of strong criticism melts away, as we saw, for example, with Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi of China with respect to whether or not China is a currency manipulator, or it's about embrace in terms of creating a sort of mutual support system that will all hold each other up, as, for example, with Mr. Trump's recent invitation to Mr. Duterte from the Philippines, who's been accused of
extrajudicial killings, if I can put it.
Extrajudicial, that's right. Yes, exactly. And sort of being at least directly involved indirectly involved in some way. These are concerning. These are concerning moments for us, sure.
Let me go, as you were talking, Manu, I was thinking of the end of World War II, and obviously, you know, the much of the world went through an incredibly devastating war. Europe, in many ways, was destroyed from all the bombing. There were peace treaties, things were signed, there was the Marshall Plan, things were rebuilt. I've taken trains in Europe. They're better than the trains we have in the United States. But it seems like we were, as a world or large parts of the world, able to rebuild from that. Are we in a similar situation now with globalization? It just feels like there's never going to be a treaty with ISIS or with whatever's left with Al-Qaeda. That will go on and on. How does that change the chance for reform?
If the first question is, are we in the same place as we were after World War II? The answer is no. That had wiped out all of the existing structures. We're at a critical point. If there's any comparison to be made to that period, it might be, and this is very unfortunate, but the 1930s, perhaps, right. Which is we're on the cusp of a big conflict, possibly. Prognosticating in these ways is a difficult business. I'm a historian. I prefer to look to the past, where we can sort of say these things happen in these ways and analyze those, rather than to say exactly what's going to come next. But we can use this as a bit of an analytical tool to say we seem to see the chessboard set up in a certain way looks grim. The possible moves that each piece on the board can make also looks to be headed towards something catastrophic.
Wow.
It's too late yet. I don't think it's too late yet. We can act, but we'll need to act fast, both within the sense of trying to address what Professor Levine is very correctly identifying, political polarization. We've got to sort of reweave the fabric of things that hold us together. For example, let's also identify some of the causes of this. I mean, cable news and social media have really created bubbles and fractured our our way of talking to one another, pulled us away from our neighbors. One thing we can do is, rather than trying to have debates all the time with someone on the opposing side, let's try to reform these into sort of fruitful conversations where we identify places of difference, we talk about those differences, and then the objective at the end is not to sort of go back into our corners in a huff, but to say, look, here are one, two, or three things on this topic that we can agree on. At least that way we sort of say, look, we identify with our political challenger or political opponent in all of these very important and essential ways. So while we have our disagreements, they don't break us apart in our essence.
Howard, we have a couple of comments here I want to toss at you. One from Andy, a tweet from Andy says, your guests avoid using white nationalism or supremacy to describe the motivation behind Trump's election. The question from Andy is, why?
I think the term white nationalism, you know, is perhaps unnecessarily provocative, but I wouldn't avoid it. I think in political science we tend to talk about ethnocentrism, racial resentment, and concepts that are close enough in meaning to white nationalism, and I think it's been acknowledged within political science and in general that the rise of Barack Obama was linked to a rise in the politicization of racial attitudes, of ethnocentrism. And I think Donald Trump has sort of accelerated that politicization. And so I think we're in a moment, in which partisanship now has sort of brought into its vortex not only sort of lifestyle and culture, but also attitudes related to ethnicity, gender, and race. And so it's really quite a potent stew of cultural conflict.
And of course, candidate Trump, or even businessman Trump, was the original, or one of the original birthers, saying about Barack Obama, he was the other, sort of feeding Howard what we've been talking about.
Oh, indeed. I think that this really took off under President Obama. But the other thing to keep in mind, is that when people answer these kinds of questions, is Barack Obama Muslim? Was Barack Obama born in the United States? They're not necessarily, answering the question that you think they're answering. They might also be just simply, answering the question, do I like or dislike Barack Obama? And so when you give people incentives to respond accurately, these kinds of conspiratorial beliefs tend to decrease substantially. So
Manu,
it's unclear whether these are true beliefs or whether these are sort of expressions of dislike.
Manu, here's an email from Janice who says, our country seems to be leaning towards oligarchy. I wonder how this meshes with authoritarianism. Do you agree with her assessment?
To the extent that, what appears to be one of Mr. Trump's concerns is, reinforcement of his vast empire and his brand, and sort of the network of very rich people who've been placed into positions of power in his government and who seem to benefit from things like his tax plan. The first person who benefits from it apparently is himself primarily, but then the next range are these allies. Yes, it's a concern. And just going back to the sort of the previous comment or question about white nationalists, that too is a concern. I don't know that it necessarily drove the election or the victory per se, although the outrageous sort of racialized comments made during the campaign certainly fed that kind of a base. But the alt-right, as it's known, has certainly emerged very influentially. It has become very influential after the election, and that is concerning with Mr. Bannon in the White House, or Mr. Gorka in the White House, Mr. Miller, and a range of people on the side, like Mr. Spencer, who've all taken very prominent places in our political conversations since the election. I think these are, tremendously concerning.
Let me play another caller who called our comment line.
My name is Gene, calling from Philadelphia, Fairmount. My question for the guests is, do they think that the growth of the national security state and the Patriot Act are manifestations of this totalitarian trend in American society. I don't think it's supported by American society, but it certainly has been endorsed and cultivated by our elected officials.
Howard, that's kind of a variation on the woman who sent us an email. Do you want to respond to that?
Sure. I mean, I think what has changed after 9/11 is sort of a rebalancing of the priorities of Americans. So perhaps we are, you know, and have been over the past, you know, 16 years, more willing to trade off privacy for, you know, more national security. And so it was an understandable response, you know, after 9/11 to make that trade-off. And, you know, as salient terrorist acts ebb and flow, Orlando, Paris, Nice, San Bernardino, and so on, you know, these kinds of policies are going to become more popular. And, you know, they're going to become incentives for, you know, rightist parties to propose them. And that, I think, is a dynamic that we've, you know, been seeing here now since 9/11.
Well, no, I was thinking about, we've been talking about authoritarianism, whether it kind of exhausts itself. Obviously, it's going to vary from one country to the other, whether it ends up disappointing its followers, especially in a democracy, whether it leads to dictatorship or to war. Those are all rather depressing things to think about. But I guess my question is sort of, how does this end, Money?
I think everything you just said is on the table. I mean, we know that, well, there are different actors. I mean, we sort of have avoided talking about Vladimir Putin or giving him adequate time in this discussion. And he is who I fear his agenda may be driving a lot more of this than we've credited. Russia, I think, misses its place in the world. This is a way of sort of destabilizing the order that's emerged since the fall of the Soviet Union and sort of reestablishing Russian primacy. War is a possibility. I mean, war is a possibility not just because of our current engagement in conflict with North Korea, unstable actors like Kim Jong-un, but also because of people who seem to sort of say, I just want a strong nation state, but those will bring each of us into conflict over time. So that is one option, certainly. Also, the failure of their promises will result in, or connected to these conflicts may result in restrictive dictatorial measures, totalitarian measures within states to shore up their power. The historian Timothy Snyder, for example, is warning us that it seems, he claims, is inevitable that this may happen here because of failures and so on. And then the last possibility is that we somehow recalibrate and marshal the forces necessary to undo this. We did see, for example, in the Dutch elections that Geert Wilders came up short. And not only did he come up short, but the Green Links, led by Jesse Klaver, sort of managed to pull forward and succeed in a way that no one expected. Similarly, we've seen the collapse of Ms. Petry and the AfD in Germany, the resurgence of the Social Democrats, and we are yet to find out exactly what's going to happen in France. But good luck to Mr. Macron, we must hope.
Manu Bhagavan, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My pleasure.
Our pleasure as well. Professor of History and Human Rights at Hunter College and the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Howard Levine, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a professor of political science and psychology at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center for the Study of Political Psychology. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.